Thanks, Philippe and Tara. This is Titian and Corey coming to you live from Musgrave Park.
Good here morning. In Brisbane.
Good morning. Good morning. Broadcasting from Jagera land and broadcasting to land stolen from Indigenous peoples right around the country. So coming up on this morning's show, Corey, we've got a discussion with Dale Ruska, who's from North Stradbroke Island here in Queensland, and discussing the limitations of native title and why that sort of didn't really work out for his mob, and alternative visions of Indigenous land rights.
Yeah, and we've also got a brief interview with Kieran O'Reilly, who's a famous anti-war activist, done some pretty cool things in his life, and as a result, has now been banned from the G20.
I'm really looking forward to hearing that one. So first, we'll hear Dale Ruska.
All right. I'm sitting in Musgrave Park talking to Dale Ruska, who's one of the original First Nations people living in Stradbroke Island. Dale, we've just ducked out of a forum on native title. As I understand it, you were the applicant for one of the earliest native title claims. Can you tell us a little bit about the time that you put in the claim and how people were feeling about native title at that point in time?
Well, our claim started before native title became law. We were sort of following suit with Mabo, and the opportunity to have our rights recognised as the first people presented all of the elders of that time who were coming out of their eras of significant oppression with great hope. But over time, as it progressed, and after the first decade or so, it was realised by many that native title wasn't about bringing justice to us as the original people. It was about securing and validating the rights established through colonial occupation and control.
Can you tell me about some of the first things that made you and others start to question the whole native title process?
Well, immediately we started to question it, because one of the first things we had to do when our claim was lodged was to recognise all of the other parties that had interests in our claim area. For our claim and the boundaries of it, there were at least 48, I think it was, registered interests immediately against our claim. And those interests were from the federal government, the state government, the local government, industry groups like the mining company, right down to individual business owners. The way the Native Title Act progresses is the rights and interests of all of those other parties are securely established, and native title has to be negotiated more or less around those interests being ensured to continue to survive without being interfered with in any way or form.
Can you maybe talk about some of the ways that relationships between people within your community changed over the course of the native title application?
Yeah, well, native title caused great division, division that lasted on our island for at least a decade or more. The division was caused because some people were convinced to believe that native title and what was being offered by the state government through the legal processes was all that there was to be accomplished and gained. And they were convinced by legal representatives and by state representatives that if they didn't accept what was being offered through the native title process, that they were more than likely going to get nothing at all. Some of us believe that, well, we've had nothing for this long through that common law system and through colonial control by way of recognition of our rights and entitlements as First People, so we'll just remain with nothing in that sense, and we'll reserve our sovereign First Nationhood entirely. Some of the others, through being convinced that way, through the threat of risk, more or less agreed to accept what was being offered because they believed that they weren't going to get anything at all, because they'd been part of this claim which had been going for 22 years. So, yeah, it was just out of more or less wanting to resolve it and wanting to get something as a result of that resolution.
And you mentioned when you were talking in the circle before about some of the things that the governments were asking, and it seemed like they were holding native title as a kind of a leverage on your community. So they wanted to have sand mining, they wanted you know, a whole bunch of concessions from your people in return for native title. Do you want to talk about some of the things that the government and industry were demanding in return for native title?
Well, native title itself is a piece of corrupt legislation, and it's about forcing our people to compromise our First Nationhood and our originality and to accept the interests that have all been established under the process of colonial occupation and rule and control. Native title isn't really about First Nationhood. It's about what rights may have survived throughout the era of colonial history and what rights the government, federal, state and local are willing to accept. And in their willingness to accept, they need to ensure that the rights of the majority through the democratic system are maintained and upheld within their system of common law. And for Aboriginal people, it's about proving what rights may have survived if you can prove that you have connections to the country that's being claimed. One of the biggest insults that I think most First Nations people around the country are faced with in reaching a consent determination of native title, that's to keep it out of the court processes, is they have to agree to validate all of the past and future invalid acts that have been committed by the state government against them and their place. So in reality, we're being asked to legalise all of the illegal crimes and injustices that have been historically committed against our people and that will continue to be committed into the future through that one act of validation. And for many of us, that one act of validation was just too big of an ask. So we just can't consent.
You also talked a little bit about some of the processes that are used to negotiate a consent determination. And you talked about how the lawyers and, you know, some of the people in government, you know, tried to kind of push your people to settle for less, really, than what you're entitled to. Do you want to it seems like the actual process of the way these things are negotiated, the powers in the hands of, you know, government and lawyers. Do you want to comment on that at all?
Oh, absolutely. The power relating to the control of the whole native title process isn't about Aboriginal people being in control of the outcome and of their fate and their place's fate. It's simply a process of dictatorship. It's dictated to us and we're told what we have to do and how we have to do it and which way we have to go and which way we can't go. And we don't have a real choice in relation to our true identity and our true entitlements as original people regarding our land and its natural environment and its natural resource wealth and the controls that we enjoyed for millenniums prior to colonial occupation. We have no say over any of those ancient rights or entitlements. It's merely the ones that we're allowed to through that process of dictatorship and through administration. And when we look at how the process occurs, it's facilitated by Australian common law and Australian governments, the same law and the same governments which maintain responsibility for all of the crimes of injustice that have been committed against us throughout the whole era of colonial historical occupation and right up until now. It's not at all about our desires. As I said, it's about dictatorship of our entitlements from within that common law structure, and it's about the administration of our rights by the governments and all the other interested parties so that the rights that we receive as being recognised is acceptable and suitable to them so it doesn't affect or interfere with them in any shape or form. For all First Nations people, and I think it's a very important point to regard, is how can we expect justice from the system of law and from the representative of the people through their parliaments, and how can we expect justice from them when they are the ones that are working within the system which is responsible for all of the crimes of injustice that are being committed against us? We can't get justice from within an unjust system.
Yeah, you've talked a lot about making your own pathways towards justice. But perhaps you could tell me a bit about the One Mile settlement, what it was and why you set it up.
Well, One Mile's an old settlement, and there's 1 miles all around Australia, and under the Aboriginal Protection Act, 1 mile was the legal distance that any of our people were allowed to live adjacent to a white settlement. So I was born into a 1 mile on Stradbroke Island, and my life and my whole life journey commenced from that 1 mile with my old great-grandpeople who were subjects to the oppression of Aboriginal protection and Aboriginal assimilation. We've maintained our connection with One Mile, and One Mile was also the basis of our whole entire claim over the Quandamooka region because of that continuation and maintenance of our connection. One Mile was also an area which was subject to native title. For the majority of us, and I would say the majority being about 98% of us that are now still connected to One Mile, we chose that we weren't going to wait for the state government to recognise our rights and give that land back to us. We knew it was ours, so we just went and we started taking it back. And we haven't waited for the government to provide us with financial resources to assist us in our housing needs. We've just gone and we've obtained our own resources and started building our own homes on our own land. And we've asked government to recognise our First Nationhood entitlement to occupy that land. And we've held up a native title process and transfer of that land over to a prescribed body corporate under the Aboriginal Lands Act because the government has to address our concerns because we've put it into submission forms to them in response for the notification of intention. In our request, we've asked government in recognising our First Nationhood to consider creating a whole new form of land title which recognises the First Nation right to occupy their land for the purpose of residence, and native title doesn't do that. And in our right to occupy, we don't want the land given to us in the same forms of European title where it can be just granted in freehold. So many of our people, because of their socioeconomic status, will be faced with the possibility of then selling that land. We want it given to us so it can be held in perpetuity forever and a day in an inalienable form of title, so it can only be transferred down to our descendants in our family groups.
Can you tell me a bit more about this autonomous way of organising that you've been using and some of the strengths of that and the kind of tactics that you've been using?
Well, the autonomous way is only cultural. We don't get any support from governments or councils or associations. As soon as we become a registered organisation, we lose our ability to be self-determination and have self-control and self-autonomy. So we've chosen to remain unregistered and unincorporated as a collective. Our autonomy comes from ourselves and us accepting our birthright entitlements and collectively gathering to determine where we take that collective view of entitlement, and that's the way we've progressed it so far. And for us as a people nationally, we need some sort of mechanisms put in place which allows us to assemble in a structural manner and to be able to access resources, especially when you consider the extent of the resources and the economy that's being generated from resource extraction from within our lands. Some of that should be, or all of it should be, rightfully ours, and if it was, we'd be totally capable of being responsible for the facilitation of our own self-development, our self-determination and our self-autonomy.
You mentioned that you needed a treaty between Aboriginal people before you can, make a treaty with the colonising people. Do you want to talk a bit about the ways that you're building a collective will amongst different Aboriginal groups?
Well, it's not so much about building a collective will. There's already a system of basic principles and values that exists, which relates to our customary connections to our land, which is shared principles and values right across the country, and from those principles and values we obtain our original identities and our originality. And it's those principles that we need to use as the foundation for the establishment of a treaty between ourselves, agreeing to what it is as an identity we are entitled to, and how we're going to go about getting those entitlements recognised legally so that we allow proper justice to prevail.
Do you think that this meeting that we're having this week in Musgrave Park is an important part of that process?
This is a very important part of that process because it's a representation of the people that share those values and principles of originality. And from meetings and gatherings like this, things grow to become national positions and will, like it's sung in songs, from little things, big things come. So, yes, this meeting and its assembly is very important and significant.
Is there anything else that you want to add on the topic of, you know, why we're here this week and, you know, the G20 summit?
I think why most of the people are here is because they feel totally dissatisfied and totally humanly betrayed as a result of the colonial occupation and control that has now gone on for over 200 years of our places around the land of Australia. As I mentioned in my talk, we're not just traditional owners, we're not just native title holders. We didn't just arrive 200 years ago, we were here from our beginning, and our beginning goes back to tens and tens and tens of thousands of years ago. Yeah, and it's because of that shared value and shared agreement of principle and that shared opinion of that there's no justice within the current common law system, and that proper justice for us as the first people is a long way off. And it's because of those reasons and those views that we are here today, and it's because we know that there's no proper justice to come from native title, there's no proper justice to come from land rights. The only way we can have proper justice is when this country accepts and recognises that we are the first original people and we are the truly rightful owners of all this land that is now occupied and called Australia, and that we should have full autonomous control as we enjoyed for millenniums prior to colonisations of all that applies to ourselves, our lands, our environments, our natural resource wealth.
My name is Bakiri Ruska, a Gurumpa woman from North Stradbroke Island. This poem is called My Motherland. My motherland, her heart is bleeding. You pollute, you steal straight from her hand. You mutilate, you devastate my sacred land. My motherland, her eyes are weeping. Now you repair the wounds you've inflicted. For far too long, we've wanted you evicted. You've scarred her heart. Now attempt to cover your tracks. You be on your way, never come back. Cease the mutilation, repair the devastation. Leave my motherland, for her eyes are weeping.
And that just then was Bakiri Ruska, and before that, Dale Ruska, both from North Stradbroke Island, talking about native title, the environment, and, yeah, protecting the motherland. Coming up, we have Kieran O'Reilly, who's a long-time peace activist. He's had some pretty amazing times, which we'll hear about. He's the third person to be banned from the G20. I think it's a bit of a badge of an honour. Shall we go for it?
You're listening to 3CR, and we're here with Kieran O'Reilly, who has been recently put on the prohibited persons list. I'd like to read a bit from this letter. I have been provided with information about you, and after considering the material, I am reasonably satisfied that you are a person who should be included on the prohibited persons list. What did you do?
I know, it's a mystery. They wouldn't explain what that was, you know, and whether it's my history, you know, I'm a long-standing free speech activist. I was arrested here in 1977 while I was at high school during the street march scenes, and I've primarily been an anti-war activist, a pacifist, 35 years, whether it was that history or whether it was my intention to engage President Obama around the continued persecution of Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. You know, so it's all guesswork.
I understand you put out a press release saying that you were going to shirt front Obama.
Yes, that was my media collective thought that, you know, shirt fronting is obviously part of the diplomatic lexicon, as Julie Bishop said, and Tony Abbott was practitioner of. So I thought, oh, well, if it's good enough for the Prime Minister, it must be safe enough. I don't even know what it is. I think it's a Victorian Aussie rules thing. But, so, yeah, it was to non-violently confront Obama about its persecution of Manning, Snowden and Assange.
And who do you think would win in a non-violent fight between you and the military force of the United States?
Well, I've engaged US military on a number of occasions. We disabled the B-52 bomber in upstate New York on the eve of the Gulf War and put it out of action for the length of the war. And then in 2003, during the invasion, we did $2.5 million damage to a US warplane at Shannon Airport. Most US troops that went to Iraq went through neutral Ireland, and we disabled the plane and sent it back to Texas. And the first case, I served 13 months in jail in the United States before receiving the more traditional punishment for someone of Irish extraction of transportation to Australia. And then in Dublin, we were acquitted and found not guilty at our third trial.
And on what grounds were you found not guilty?
We defend ourselves under the Irish Criminal Damage Act that says if you damage property to preserve a property or life of another, that you can run a defence on that. And we had very good lawyers who laid the basis for that defence. And we had former US military who killed people in Iraq come and testify on our behalf and all sorts of people. So it was a great trial and a lot of good evidence got in. And it's interesting that WikiLeaks revealed some of the cables from the US Embassy in Dublin, and they were really, you know, obviously pissed off and freaked out by the Irish jury's response to our action.
I'm going to read again from this letter. As a consequence of your inclusion on the prohibited persons list, should you enter or attempt to enter a G20 security area during the above-mentioned period, you will be committing an offence under Section 72 of the Act and could be arrested. Do you think that's going to stop you?
No, probably not. I mean, I have to give some thought to what my response to this is now. And, you know, my brother was here. We've been getting beaten up since we were 17 and this by the Queen's Temple. So, you know, I'll take soundings from him and other people who've known me for a long time and work out if I'm match fit to take it to the next level.
You know,
in the shirt front. I've got 24 hours or so to think about it, I guess. My name's Kieran O'Reilly, and you're listening to 3CR. Community radio is very, very important because, you know, people like Murdoch are running the media. So all power to your elbow.
Kieran O'Reilly, long-time peace and anti-war activist, talking about the fact that he's the third person now to be excluded, to be given an official exclusion notice for the G20. And it's Tishan and Corey here with you this morning on 3CR Community Radio, broadcasting live from Musgrave Park in Brisbane. And joining us now on the mic is a friend of 3CR, Gadjala man Gary Santo. Welcome, Gary.
Hey, good morning to all, and good morning to all your listeners at 3CR.
Now, I really wanted to bring you in on this kind of discussion this morning to reflect on the interview that we had earlier with Dale Ruska about land rights, native title, and some of the drawbacks, and just to hear your reflections from your experience up. You're from north of here.
That's right.
Around Charters Towers way, yep. and you've been sort of facing similar issues in terms of mining, and have recently got a native title determination in your favour.
Yes, that's correct. Can I just start off by saying how inspirational it was to listen to Dale's speech yesterday with a wealth of knowledge, and I just got so much from listening to him. I've never met him officially until after his presentation, his speech, and I could not help. I was compelled to reach out and shake his hand and congratulate him, and he's a man of courage and great wealth of knowledge, and it was quite a privilege to hear him speak yesterday. Yes, we're pretty much on the cusp of our native title and how it's affecting our community back up in Charters Towers, insofar as much as we're pretty much new to it. We don't have the networks with the major local region. We don't have people who've been involved in the courts with it as such. So we have to grapple with our native title in our communities by ourselves. And of course, we have factions within the community, people who think native title is good and people who think native title is bad. I like to think I'm privileged. I'm one of the ones who think it's bad. listening to Dale and the resistance, the resilience they got against the whole structure, the destructive legislation that native title is, This is something that I can take back to my community and perhaps trying to convince those who are pretty much staunch and running with this native title, this destructive legislation. So, yes, I think it's something that has to be looked at for what it's really worth. And its worth is zinch, zero, nothing. It doesn't offer nothing. As Dale pointed out, all it does is offer the government legislation to legitimise their colonisation and the taking of resources as well.
Yeah. So we're here at the Decolonisation Before Profit First Nations response to the G20. Yesterday's theme of the convergence was all about native title, and you talked about the meeting Dale and listening to him and others yarn about it. Now, today's theme for the day is deaths in custody, and coming up at 9 a.m. Brisbane time is going to be the rally and march from the centre of town. And
one of many. I mean, you know, there's a rally and march here every time there's a black death in custody, which is unfortunately way, way too often.
Absolutely.
And we're actually going to be bringing you some of that on 3CR during Black and Deadly, 11 a.m. Melbourne time. We'll be crossing from the rally and hopefully be getting some of the speeches from some of the really amazing staunch activists here campaigning against the ongoing...
genocide?
Ongoing genocide.
Just on that, Tish, and can I just add to the listeners out there, there's a new concept of the terminology involved. I think you hear around the camp this morning and over the past few days, people are calling it murder in custody now.
Fair enough.
And I think that's more appropriate as such. It's a sad statement, but it's come down to that, basically. I mean, death in custody just doesn't seem to fit the title anymore. Murder in custody seems to be the ultimate title for what's these actions that's happening at the moment. Just like to point that out.
Absolutely. No, I'm really glad you brought that up. I think it's really powerful. And I think when you bring that up, what you're sort of bringing up is really the power in the words that we use. And the term deaths in custody was came out of the Royal Commission.
That's right.
It comes from this colonial.
It's so much a sterile terminology now. Yeah. It doesn't really reflect the actual actions, what's happening behind the scenes, the genocidal practice. And that's what it stems from. It stems from the genocidal practice, a continuation from the original intent of genocide. So, you know, let's call it for what it really is, folks. It's murder in custody.
Right on. So we're here broadcasting to you live from Musgrave Park up in Brisbane, a couple of hundred metres away from the Brisbane Convention Centre, where so-called leaders from around the world are converging to discuss their plans for further enriching themselves at the cost of people and planet. And here in Musgrave Park, we're seeing an alternative vision. It's the First Nations Convergence, Decolonisation Before Profit. Really privileged, I think, for us to be able to be broadcasting here and speaking to all the really amazing folks that have come here. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Gary, and hopefully we'll have you back on air in the next couple of days as we continue to broadcast here on 3CR.
No, it's too easy. Thank you very much.
Also this morning, there's the Visioning Another World G20 People's Summit. We've got... I hope that this is a literal statement. Everyone gets ice cream from 11:45 to 1. That's about what's happening inside the G20 and what's happening outside. So I'm imagining the people inside are getting ice cream and we're getting, you know, security.
Creamed.
Yep. And then we've got miners shot down, the Americana story. We've got a thing on independent media. And the disparity between wealth. Yeah, you know, all sorts of interesting stuff. Anyway, if you're interested, you should find yourself a program and get to it.
Great. So that's all from us from Musgrave Park. We'll be back with you at 11 a.m. for Black and Deadly, broadcasting live from the rally, the Murders in Custody rally. Coming up next on 3CR Community Radio is Beyond Zero Emissions. You've been listening to a podcast of 3CR's live coverage from the G20 in Brisbane. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. To listen to more podcasts or donate online, go to 3cr.org.au.